So, welcome everybody. I really do appreciate you joining me and sharing your time with us here in Alaska. Who's from out of town? Everybody? Yeah, so I'll make this short. We can get out and have fun in the little bit of sun that we get in the summer. But I grew up in Warren, Michigan. It's a suburb of Detroit. And I moved out here in 1996, and we dabbled a little bit outside of the state, but for the most part, we've been here since 1996. When I grew up, my dad was a workman's comp lawyer out of Detroit. That's where all the cars are made, right? So we have big companies, big GM plants, big Ford plants. So my dad, in his work, would bring it home with him, and he'd show me these horrific incidents, right? They're occupationally related. They're coming out of the car factories. There's pictures. There's grotesque injury stories behind it. I was fascinated, right? So I didn't exactly follow him into law, but I did become a paramedic and started working for a fire department in another suburb of Detroit called Taylor. So when a new model year comes out or a new plant design or new engine design comes out, all the car factories have to retool. And during this retooling process, there is an influx of thousands of workers, skilled craft, that come in to move the electrical lines, move the hydraulic lines, and, you know, work with the big machinery that stamps out the cars. And during these times, there is a great potential for injury, and it happens quite often. This is, you know, my time as a firefighter, this is back in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, right? So injury rates back then, especially in the car plants, were quite high. The reason I'm telling you this is I was sitting in one of these car plants pulling some overtime. So when they retooled the plants, firefighters from around the greater Detroit area could go to these plants and work on some overtime, work on their ambulance. I mean, it was that drastic. It was that kind of injury system there. So it was during one of these times that I was talking to the plant safety manager, and he was telling me what he did. Basically, he was the fire chief. He was the medic. He worked on the preventative measures. He was the industrial hygienist. As soon as I heard the term industrial hygienist, I knew that's what I needed to be in life, right? So I went, I went through some more schooling. I became a nurse, and I knew I wanted to get into industrial hygiene and public health. So that's what I did, and that's where I am today. So the reason I'm telling you this, it'll make sense a few slides from now when you get into this, what we did here. The title of this is The Impact of Near-Miss Reporting on Safety Performance. So near misses are important in the world, not just in construction, but in a lot of different sectors in industry. So I guess I didn't go into this very well, but in my passion for occupational health, I kind of found my path in construction. Construction is, especially big construction, if you think about it, I'm just like the guy back in that car factory. I'm the fire chief, I'm the nurse, I'm the medic, I'm the industrial hygienist, and that's what I was drawn to, and I became safety manager through these large construction projects. So construction is hard. We all know this, public health professionals. It remains one of the most dangerous occupations in the United States and in the world. The fatality rate is usually 2.5 to 3 times that of the general population. The International Labor Organization, the ILO, estimates that there's about 164 workers killed per day around the world in construction. The yearly economic impact is huge in the United States, and I can tell you there's a lot of effort out there to control this and decrease these rates and the impact to the construction workforce. So near misses. Near misses, everybody's doing it, right? Everybody's doing it. You can find the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the FAA, oil and gas, hospitals, blood banks, the National Fire Near Miss Database. A lot of these organizations are very sophisticated and run complex analysis on their near misses. And their rates show that this effort is working, right? The rates in these businesses, or the rates in errors in these businesses, are continually going down while construction remains stagnant year after year. So I found myself as a safety manager in a liquid natural gas plant in Angola, Africa. And this is 2008. We mobilized in March of 2008, and we were doing well. We had no serious events, but we had a low level of non-serious events. We call them recordables, you know, anything requiring a prescription or a stitch, a suture. But again, we were doing well. But I still wanted to stop that. The goal of my program, or the goal of what I do, is to stop the next first aid case, to stop the next recordable injury in construction. So I did some research on these organizations. I found out what they did, and I copied it. I took what I could, I plagiarized a bit, and stuck it into a construction matrix. During that search, you find that if you look up EBSCO, or look up near miss on EBSCO, you get quite a few hits. But you drill down the data into construction, you don't really find a lot. On the other hand, if you go to YouTube, you get 103,000 hits on near misses, all kinds of crazy stuff out there, right? But nothing to do with construction. So what is a near miss?
Here's one they just made up. Near miss. But two planes almost collide, they call it a near miss. It's a near hit. A collision is a near miss. Look, they nearly miss.
Says George Carlin on near misses. So it is kind of a funny topic. If you start talking to a large group of safety professionals or construction safety professionals, and you ask everybody to agree on what is a near miss, you're not going to get a lot of agreement. It's a hard concept, right? Because as George Carlin said, did they nearly hit? Did they nearly miss? Is an unsafe condition a near miss? For example, the cords along the wall there, that's an unsafe condition. But is it a near miss? Do you really need to have an action involved or an energy release for it to be a near miss? These are questions that are constantly asked. So, defining a near miss, how I did it, during my program or during this program in Angola, I just said, it's simply, if we can learn from it, I want to hear about it. We'll call it a near miss. So whether it's an unsafe behavior or unsafe condition, call it a near miss and let me know. We developed a program. It went something like this: if you see a near miss or an unsafe condition, if you're in immediate danger, you take immediate corrective action, right? If it's not, then you turn it into me. I'll evaluate the severity. I did that with some of my other safety crew. If it's a high potential severity, then we do a near miss investigation. That's a little more complex. If it's not high potential severity, then it gets cataloged and addressed through some further investigation. I'll show you on the next slide. I guess the difference between what I did and what existed is the number of near misses and the intent. Unfortunately, in a lot of different construction projects or even between companies, if you report a near miss and it's serious, there's a non-zero probability that somebody is going to get in trouble, right? So if you left, for example, a propane bottle with a regulator on and it's leaking gas, that's a potential very serious event, right? So if you report yourself that you left it open, or you report your coworker, some organizations will fire you or that coworker. All right? Or I should use a better example, fall protection. Falls always being one of the number one killers in construction. There's a on many of these construction sites or these construction projects, there's a zero allowance for it. If you get caught at height without proper harness, without proper protective measures, you're fired. Right? So, if the consequences are severe, but again, I mobilized with most of these people on this project in 2008. It took some time, but I developed some trust. I promised everybody if it was not a deliberate act, then nobody would get fired. I just wanted to hear about it and I wanted to improve, right? So, the causation map from Rasmussen and James Reason and Vanderschaft, these are injury researchers. And after asking everybody on this construction project to tell me about their near misses and their and what's happening out in the field, I had to analyze it. And to analyze it, I choose the incident causation model, which has three different types of human error, or three different types of error. Those are technical failures, human operator failures, and organizational failures. In other words, or another way of saying this is from Rasmussen, is an SRK model. That's skills, rules, knowledge-based errors. So, a skill-based error in construction would be a simple slip. That means you're trying to hammer a nail and you miss, right? A trip, it's a whole body movement. Not really, there's not a lot you can do in the way of an awareness campaign or more training to take the error out of people missing a nail. It's kind of a muscle memory thing. There's not a lot you can do. What the typical construction environment is, somebody hits their thumb with a hammer, you put them through some training, right? Rule-based errors, these are things that may or may not be intentional, but they happen quite a bit. Those are due to simple confusion or training on an operator or verification. Knowledge-based errors are simple acts of something you either knew or something that you know or you forgot or something that you never knew and would thus become a training error. In any case, every near miss that was reported to me came in and was analyzed with this through this model. So what that meant is under normal situations with in the old regime of near miss reporting, we would get one or two near misses reported a week, right? Not a lot to act on, and they were usually pretty significant near misses. Nobody was telling you anything you didn't know already. So these near misses were, you know, somebody almost getting backed over by a track hoe or maybe an excavation near miss. They were big events and were investigated like a true incident. We went from 1 to 2 a week to over 150 a week after I introduced this near miss program. So that was a rich data source. My bosses, they took it okay. I mean, if you think about it, you're going from 1 to 2 near misses a week to 150 a week. You're thinking that things are getting out of control, a little more chaos, but that wasn't the case. We're just hearing about it now, right? So here's a public health problem. What I did with this program, I needed to do two things. I needed to stop the next injury, and I needed to write an MPH thesis, right? So this is it. We had 7,500 people on this construction project in Angola that I'm telling you about. It's about 440,000 hours a week. So it's a rich data source. We had very low incident rates. They were in the range of a 0.35 to 0.45 total recordable incident rate. So that's very low, very respectable in the injury. But that still means that's a recordable injury every 10 days or so, every 10 to 12 days. And it was just too much. So we did the program. I analyzed it for a while. And did it work? Well, for first aid cases, there was not a statistically significant outcome, right? But for recordables, something a little more serious, at a moderately, at an R of 0.45, a modest correlation between the rate of near misses being reported and the rate of recordables during that time. But let's take a look at it. Here's a near miss count versus the first aid count, right? So the first aids are in red. I'm sorry about the graphic. First aids are in red. You can see a downward trend. And the near miss reporting is in blue, right? So inverse correlation there. Here's another way of looking at that. This is a Six Sigma control chart. You see the solid black line there. That's average for near misses over a certain time period, 13 weeks prior to the intervention and 13 weeks after. And you see during the intervention that we had a statistically significant decrease in events. Right? Yet another way of looking at this, a Poisson probability, or the probability of having a first aid event. If you read this as, well, first thing that comes out of you, this looks like a normal distribution, right? These are first aid cases. First aid cases at about 440,000 hours a week, that's about 15 to 20 first aid cases. First aid cases can be anything from a rash to an ingrown toenail to dust in the eye. So all these kind of random things that come in that we see in the clinic. Okay? So it's random, the normal distribution. I thought that was quite striking, right? So the red is the normal distribution. The blue, if you can see, we've scooted over to the left a little, right? We pulled it in a bit. So we were able to act with everything else being equal. I should have mentioned this. This was a quasi-experimental study. So my construction project was compared to two other similarly sized, similarly scoped construction projects within the company. So their rates did not change. Our rates did during this intervention. And everything else was equal. There was no other changes. There was no other corporate mandates or reporting changes or anything like that. It was just the interdiction of this near-miss program. Recordable. These are rare events. Again, I told you these are at 440,000 hours a week. That's about a recordable every 10 to 12 days. It could be anything from one simple suture to one dose of prescription medication. But the true impact of this program was on the more energy intense recordable injuries. So we were able to stop recordable injuries for 110 days. Right? Again, everything else being equal, no other changes, just the reaction of pulling in the near miss data, about 25 a day, reacting it on it, and feeding it back to everybody on the site that very next day. So it was immediate distribution of the data. So if 10 insulators reported that they weren't wearing, or a report of 10 insulators not wearing their goggles happened in the pipe rack over here, then the very next morning everybody knew about this. Right? So it was kind of a management tool and a rich source of public health data. So the barriers he had to overcome. Fear of retaliation, because you don't want to report a near miss on your buddy and get him in trouble, right? But that's the old regime. This was an open source, and there was, I must say, a lot of trust that was out there that allowed us to do this. The fear that reporting reflects poorly on performance. That's something you had to overcome with management, because now you went from two near misses to 150 near misses being reported a week. That sounds bad, but it was a rich source of data that we were acting on. The enablers, the big enabler was communication. Talking early and talking and asking the people to help you with the program was very important. I simply asked when I kicked this off, is I wanted three near misses per person per year from everybody on site, and they complied. Or at least while I was there, they started reporting the near misses and the results, or what I just mentioned. So the conclusion is that the foundation of trust is essential for this to work. The place I'm in right now, I'm in Tengiz, Kazakhstan. It is a not mature program, not like what we had in Angola. So this would not work. I can tell that already. We have a lot of work to do just to get things safe. You know, electrical outlets and construction equipment and everything else. So there's a certain maturity of a program that you have to identify before you can work this. I think the most important or the best thing that came out of this was the classification scheme, the error classification. That actually came back. I'll go back to it. This Eindhoven classification actually came from the University of Eindhoven, and it was related to blood transfusions, of all things. So I modified this a bit to make it construction specific and started using it. And it has been, it's been great ever since. So I recommend anybody who has a capacity or the yearning for this is to look this up or contact me for more information. I can easily email all the math and all the other details along with my thesis if you ask. That's my email address. You have any questions? Thanks. These are my kids in Seward. Go ahead.
So once you started getting all these near miss reports and you followed up on them, did you have to increase your safety staff to go and investigate and rectify these problems that were reported?
No, I didn't have to increase them. We, you know, with 7,500 people, you have a safety staff of 46 and then 8 firefighters. So I didn't have to increase any staff, but the night crew had to do the analysis. So I had to work with them. There was a little intercoder reliability thing going on I had to work with, but once we started putting that piece together, the most important element was that morning communication, because you know there were about 100 foremen that went out with a piece of paper that showed exactly what the near misses were, who were reporting them, who they were reported against, if you will, it's a bad term, but who was actually part of the near miss, and then what to do about it. So not only did it give the information to the people out in the field, it also got the attention of the right managers, the right foreman, general foreman in the field, and the right upper level managers that would do something to lessen the frequency of their group of people making the near miss page. If you know what I mean, right? Mostly, yeah, we had a tailgate every morning. So this was Angola. We had 3,000 Angolan employees, 1,500 Filipino employees, 1,500 Indian or from India employees, and you know they're all broken up into the right language form, and so whatever we did paperwork wise had to be translated by the morning. So that when they all spread out, they had a language-specific toolbox talk. So yeah, toolbox talk was the primary means, and then we had all-hands meeting with foreman. I mean, a foreman meeting every Saturday, and then all-hands meeting every 2 weeks, and that was translated into the different languages. But along with that, posters went up. We used positive reinforcement, so the crew reporting for example, the crew reporting the most near misses in 1 week would get some form of positive reinforcement. So if that were scaffolders, then all the scaffolders on that crew reporting these near misses would get an early quit. That's important in construction because that gets you home earlier, that gets you a shower earlier, gets you fed earlier. So early quits or, you know, a small token to be used at the camp store, something like that. But next week, it may not be the crew that reported the most near misses. It might be the crew that reported the most near misses within themselves. So if a scaffolder crew, you know, they're sitting up high, they can, we call it poach, right? They could poach on other painters and insulators and everybody else and report all day long, right? But the next week, it would be, we would reward the painters because maybe the painters returned the most near misses within the painting crew instead of on everybody else. There's a lot to do with this, but it's well worth it. Go ahead.
Was it all paper-based reporting?
Yeah, that was all, that's all we could do at this point. There was no way to put computers in the field or any of that. So the near miss reporting card was pretty simple. It was just, where were you? What do you do? We put up 10 near miss reporting stations around the construction site. It was a big site. Yeah.
Did you get time of day?
Yeah, there was a date reported, time reported. So the basic facts, I still got a pretty impressive database on all that stuff. I still use it when I get into that nerdy mood of trying to calculate things. That's still pretty important. Turnover wasn't too bad. I mean,
were you doing a lot of new employee training?
So we had to do, most of the skilled craft come already trained. So pipe filled, welders, pipe fitters, equipment operators, they came trained. We did have a 3-week training session for Angolans, because this was many times their first official employment. So that 3 weeks was safety training and just getting used to the equipment, trying to find out what their niche was, what do they want to do. Yep. Yeah. Coincidentally, it's in professional safety right now. This, I think, May or June of professional safety for this year. And it was published a couple different ways. You can go to the UAA to get the get my thesis. You can download that. That is a hard one because that goes back to that definition of the near miss. It's different for everybody. You're not going to get any agreement and may even lose some friends over it trying to define it. But the best way I found was to ask if somebody could learn from whatever happened, if you can learn from it, that's what I wanted to hear about. So I stuck with that and it worked out okay.
Able, you know, like you were saying, coaching, you could report on other people. I guess because it wasn't, you weren't punishing people, but you were trying to learn from it. I'm
right.
just wondering what the dynamics between the different.
Yeah, there was a little bit of poaching for sure, and that's why we had to move it from the kind of the positive reinforcement switched between week to week, like I said. So I remember the gold standard was a near miss that you would report on yourself. You know, you did something or you forgot something. So that was a gold standard. Or sometimes it went through severity. For example, I don't like to admit this one, but we were building a gas plant and the gas alarm went off, so you have to evacuate. So 7,500 people are walking off the site, and somebody made a report of people smoking during the evacuation. So that got a lot of attention, and that won that, you know, that week's near miss reporting. But I mean, otherwise, if we didn't have this program, we never would have heard about this. Thanks. Enjoy Alaska.